What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The United States secures the backing of Gulf Arab states of Iran nuclear agreement. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will arrive in Singapore Tuesday after announcing in Doha Monday. Foreign ministers of the Gulf Cooperation Council agreed the Iran nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, will contribute to the region's security once fully implemented.
Once fully implemented, the JCPOA contributes to the region's long-term security, including by preventing Iran from developing or acquiring a military nuclear capability.
Mr. Kerry said the U.S. and GCC agreed to expand regional security through cooperation on issues including intelligence sharing, special forces training, and maritime security. President Obama planning to make a major speech this week to discuss the international accord to restrain Iran's nuclear program. A White House spokesman said Monday Mr. Obama will raise arguments he believes are central to supporting the accord, which bars Iran from building an atomic weapon in coming years, in exchange for lifting crippling Western and UN sanctions. Congress is in the midst of a 60-day review of the pact and is expected to vote next month whether to accept or reject it. If it's rejected, Mr. Obama has vowed to veto the legislation, which would force the Senate and House to muster a two-thirds majority to override. In Mali, another ambush. Suspected Islamist militants killed 11 soldiers in an attack on an army base near the northern desert city Timbuktu Monday. The pre-dawn attack followed another ambush on an army convoy in central Mali Saturday that killed two soldiers. The Mauritanian news agency says Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM, has claimed responsibility. The northern part of Mali fell under the control of Islamic extremists in 2012. This is VOA News. The U.S. Defense Department says the military launched its first armed drone missions out of Turkey's Incirlik Air Base during the past weekend. The U.S. also launched attacks against non-Islamic State forces that attacked U.S.-trained Syrian rebels fighting the IS group. A Pentagon spokesman said the attackers look an awful lot like Nusra, referring to the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, known as the al-Nusra Front. White House spokesman Josh Earnest Monday warned the Syrian regime not to impede the actions of the U.S.-trained rebel fighters.
We are principally referring to any temptation that the Assad regime may have to interfere in the air campaign against ISIL inside of Syria. What I'm suggesting is that same admonition that the Assad regime should not interfere in our counter-ISIL activities also applies to the opposition fighters that we have trained and equipped to fight ISIL. So far, the Assad regime has followed that admonition from the United States, and we encourage them to continue to do so.
The deepening U.S. role in Syria has been criticized by Russia's Foreign Secretary, Sergei Lavrov, who called for an end of foreign intervention in the Syrian conflict. President Obama Monday met with members of the Young African Leaders Initiative at the White House following his historic visits last week to Kenya and Ethiopia.
It's one of the fastest growing regions in the world. Africa's middle class is projected to grow to more than 1 billion consumers, with hundreds of millions of mobile phones and surging access to the internet. Africans are beginning to leapfrog old technologies into new prosperity. The continent has achieved historic gains in health, from fighting HIV/AIDS to making childbirth safer for women and babies. Millions have been lifted from extreme poverty. So this is extraordinary progress. And young people, like you, are driving so much of this progress.
Mr. Obama fielded questions from members of the 500 of the Yali group, ranging from climate change to UN Security Council reform and violent extremism. The director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Thomas Friedman, Monday, said Sierra Leone is stronger today than it was 6 months ago in the fight against Ebola, but the challenge remains to get to zero cases. He spoke in Freetown as two new cases of the deadly virus surfaced in the northern Tongkolili district, where a man died of Ebola last week. In Ethiopia, a court Monday sentenced nearly 20 Muslim activists to jail terms ranging from 7 to 22 years on terrorism-related charges, including an attempt to establish a religious government in the mostly Christian nation. The defendants were arrested during protests in recent years that accused the government of interference in their affairs. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington, and today is Tuesday, August 4th. Here are some of the stories we're covering. President Barack Obama greets young African leaders at a three-day summit in Washington.
And as president, I want to make sure that even as we're working with governments, we're also helping to empower young Africans like all of you. And that's why I launched YALI, Young African Leaders Initiative.
That's President Barack Obama greeting African youth in Washington. A Tanzanian parliamentarian demands the upcoming general election to be free, fair, and transparent.
We want to see that the National Electoral Commission complete the task of making sure that every eligible voter is registered in the permanent voters register.
Tundu Lissu is a Tanzanian member of parliament from the opposition Chadema Party. And economists say the depreciation of Malawi's local currency could mean sharp price increases for commodities. The second Young African Leaders Summit is underway in Washington. About 500 Mandela Washington Fellows are taking part in the three-day meeting, which opened yesterday. The U.S. State Department says they represent the extraordinary promise of an emerging generation of entrepreneurs, activists, and public officials. It says they'll engage with leaders in the public and private sectors. President Obama welcomed the young leaders.
As many of you know, I just returned from Africa, and it was my fourth trip to sub-Saharan Africa, more than any other U.S. president, and I was proud to be the first U.S. president to visit Kenya, the first to visit Ethiopia, the first to address the African Union, which was a great honor. And the reason I've devoted so much energy to our work with the continent is, as I said last week, even as Africa continues to confront many challenges, Africa is on the move. It's one of the fastest regions in the world. Africa's middle class is projected to grow to more than 1 billion consumers, with hundreds of millions of mobile phones and surging access to the internet. Africans are beginning to leapfrog old technologies into new prosperity. The continent has achieved historic gains in health, from fighting HIV/AIDS to making childbirth safer for women and babies. Millions have been lifted from extreme poverty. So this is extraordinary progress.
President Obama says young people are driving much of the progress on the continent.
I saw the power of youth on my trip in Kenya. Richard Ruto Todosia helped build Yes Youth Can, one of the country's most prominent civil society groups with over 1 million members. At the Global Entrepreneurship Summit in Nairobi, Shadi Sabe spoke about how he started Brilliant Footsteps Academy in Nigeria, which uses education to fight religious extremism and provide more opportunities for young Muslim youth. I met Judith Owiger, an entrepreneur who co-founded a nonprofit that trains young women living in the slums of Nairobi in computer programming and graphic design, and then helps place them in tech jobs. So I saw the talent of young people all across the continent. And as president, I want to make sure that even as we're working with governments, we're also helping to empower young Africans like all of you. And that's why I launched YALI, Young African Leaders Initiative.
He says the response to YALI has been overwhelming.
So far, more than 140,000 young people across Africa have joined our YALI network. So young Africans with new ideas can connect with each other and collaborate and work together to put their plans into action. And I want to welcome all of the YALI Network members across Africa who are watching this town hall today. I'm proud of all of you. I'm proud that we've made so much progress together after just a few years. And last year I said we'd launch a new set of tools for our YALI Network. So today we've got more than 30 online lessons available on everything from public speaking to how to write a business plan, mentoring, new ways to network across Africa, around the world, new training sessions, meetings with experts on how to launch a startup. And we're launching three new online Mandela Fellow, Washington Fellowship Institute courses so that all members of the YALI network can access some of the great ideas that you've been sharing.
President Obama speaking Monday at the opening of the Young African Leaders Summit in Washington. A prominent Tanzanian opposition lawmaker has called for new and improved measures to ensure the October general election is free, fair, transparent, and credible. This comes as the National Election Commission compiles a voter list for the polls. Parliamentarian Tundu Lissu told reporter Peter Cloti that the electoral body has yet to administer credible elections.
Two things. The first one relates to the ongoing voter registration exercise, particularly in areas where it has not been completed, especially here in Dar es Salaam. We want to see that the National Electoral Commission completes the task of making sure that every eligible voter is registered in the permanent voters register. The second thing that we want to see is to see to it that the Electoral Commission supervises and manages the forthcoming general elections in a manner that will ensure that the elections are as free and fair as they could be.
We heard former Prime Minister Lowassa has joined your ranks. He's picked up presidential nomination papers to represent the party ahead of the elections. What does he bring to the Chadema political table that could possibly help you significantly challenge the ruling CCM party in the October general election?
He brings two things. Number one, he literally got CCM. Lowassa is probably the most powerful political figure in the country inside CCM until a few days ago when he crossed over. So he's crossing over not only personally, but he's coming out of CCM with a considerable support from within that party. You cannot win against CCM if it is a unified CCM. Where it stands now, CCM is broken, and this is the time to take it on. The second thing is, even though Chadema and the opposition generally has worked very hard over the past 5 years, we are stronger than we have ever been. There are still considerable areas in the country where we are not as competitive as we would like to be. Former Premier Lowassa will supplement our efforts in those areas where we are not as powerful as we should be.
Now, some supporters of Chadema I spoke with in Dar es Salaam, Dodoma, and other parts of the country that I spoke with appear to be displeased with the defection of Lowassa, who some accuse of being tainted with corruption, and that embracing him in the ranks and file of the opposition Chadema basically undermines your credibility of being clean hands to fight the supposed system of CCM in the election. What do you say to such criticisms?
We want to win this election. Lowassa is the man who will get CCM. With Lowassa out, our pollsters have told us that we can take CCM on.
Tundu Lissu is a Tanzanian member of parliament from the opposition Chadema party. He spoke with reporter Peter Cloti from the commercial capital Dar es Salaam. In Malawi, economists say the depreciation of the local currency, the kwacha, against major foreign currencies will likely result in sharp price increases for commodities. Figures from various local commercial banks show the kwacha dropped by an average of 10% in July alone. Within the month, the currency dropped 11.1% against the U.S. dollar and 12% against the euro. Colleen Kalua is a local economist based in Blantyre. He speaks to VOA's Lamek Messina on the cause of the depreciation and its impacts on the lives of Malawians.
I think it
has been a deliberate devaluation by the government to probably try to increase the forex, probably through the sales of the remaining tobacco. But it has been ill-timed because we have been advising the government to be devaluing the kwacha at the beginning of the tobacco sales season, not midway or probably three-quarter way through.
When you say it's ill-timed, what do you mean exactly?
Yeah, because now the tobacco market is about to close. Unless if the government is going to extend the selling of tobacco from the 2 in September, then gains might be reaped there. But now, at the end of the day, the benefits might be lower than the cost that might come with this devaluation later.
So what impact is the depreciation of the kwacha has on the economy?
The impact will be there very shortly, because now what it means in economics, devaluation is an import tax. So whoever imports from outside into Malawi now will be paying higher tax, and that now that is going to be inflationary. It will increase the prices of commodities in the country.
But some commentators say it's surprising that the depreciation is coming at a time when Malawi has recorded high levels of foreign reserves. Are you also surprised?
It might be surprising to others, or probably, but those who affected the policy, probably they wanted to increase those reserves more than they have right now. So I think if the idea is to add more foreign exchange, then that is acceptable. But if it was done without consultation, then that's very unfortunate.
But what impact will it have on the people on the ground?
On the ground, the impact might be the next importation of fuel. When fuel runs out with the quarter divided as it is, then it means the cost of fuel go up, and that as well now it has a material effect. It will affect and every effect of the economy in the country.
So what do you think should be done to prevent the effect of the depreciation of the local currency on the lives of people?
What I think should be done is government should let the kwacha to its original value where it was before they devalued it. And actually, they should stop tampering with the kwacha. They should leave it to be the way it was, a flexible exchange rate. It is determined by the market forces.
That was Colin Kalua, a local economist based in Blantyre. He spoke to VOA's Lennox Messina on the cause and the impact of the fall of the kwacha. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm William Eagle in Washington. Today is Tuesday, August 4th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us a message. Ahead on our program, Mark Uma's Sports and our Listener of the Day. Ministries of health in Ebola-hit countries have yet to say if they will make available a new trial vaccine, which was recently announced to have a 100% efficacy rate. Médecins Sans Frontières, also known as Doctors Without Borders, is calling for the vaccine to be made available to at-risk groups as soon as possible. Rebecca Grace is the Director of Research at Epicenter, the research division of MSF. She tells Ricky Shryock that the unconventional way the vaccine was developed and tested could open up new research and development pathways for other ailments that have an even bigger impact on sub-Saharan populations.
So there's quite a few hurdles to jump through. So it's important to remember that despite these results being published, there's interim results, and so the efficacy needs to be confirmed in the future. The final results of the trial need to be analyzed, and there's more data that needs to be accrued. But what we see through these interim results is the signal that there is protection afforded by the vaccine, that the safety data that we have until date also is very promising, and there are no safety concerns. So there's no reason not to continue to ensure that individuals both in Guinea who are potentially directly exposed to infected persons as well as frontline workers have access to this vaccine. In terms of how that will happen in reality, this is, of course, an unknown scenario, and this is a new pathway for many people, including the manufacturer, the World Health Organization, and also, of course, populations. And so right now what's happening is discussions about how to ensure that this vaccine is made available as quickly as possible to those that need it. And it's most likely that the vaccine will be made available in a way that ensures that there is continuing data being accrued. There will be no mass campaign right away, but only those that are most in need receive it. And they would be followed within the context, not dissimilar from that of a phase 3 trial. That's what's called a phase 4 trial. And that's where things get sticky, because a phase 4 trial is supposed to be post-licensure. And in this case, of course, the vaccine isn't licensed.
Whose decision is it ultimately when the vaccine gets rolled out on the ground? Is it the government, or is it in conjunction with the World Health Organization?
I wish it were that simple. It's all of those people that you mentioned, and also the manufacturer. So the manufacturer of this vaccine, which is MSD, has made many promises and has guaranteed that there'll be sufficient supply available to vaccinate those in need in the three countries. And of course, the Ministry of Health and the populations themselves have to want to participate.
Are there other diseases that deserve more research and development, specifically in sub-Saharan Africa? This vaccine was developed actually quite quickly once things got moving. Does this not also show that if the resources had been dedicated 10 years ago to developing an Ebola vaccine, there would have been one by now? The vaccine would have been made available sooner.
So it's important also to remember that unfortunately, most of the morbidity and mortality in sub-Saharan Africa populations where MSF works is, of course, not due to Ebola. It's due to more benign diseases like childhood diarrhea, respiratory infections, malaria. And so in terms of research and development, it's important to look at not only diseases like Ebola that have the potential to disrupt societies, have the potential to propagate further, but also the diseases which are of greatest burden to these populations. And so one thing which will be quite interesting is that there are new pathways, new possibilities in order to help R&D move faster for both treatments, diagnostics, and in terms of diseases which affect these populations the most, diseases or conditions for that matter. And we hope that that's an outcome of this tragic event.
That was Rebecca Grace, Director of Research at Epicenter, the research division of MSF. She was speaking from South Carolina to Ricky Shryock. Those who have money have switched to power generators, gas stoves, heaters, and cookers, but South Africa's frequent load shedding has hit the large number of poor South Africans the hardest. Most of them live on less than $1.25 per day, and they say the government's failure to supply them with electricity has just turned off their lives. Thomas Kumalo reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
63-year-old Sheila Twala has lived in this house in the Johannesburg township of Soweto for the past 14 years. With no source of income, she is dependent on the government-subsidized electricity. But the current failure of the public energy utility, Eskom, to constantly supply her and millions of South Africans with reliable electricity has left her fuming.
We were very happy when we voted for our black government. We were sure that since it's now a black government in power, we will not suffer anymore because the apartheid government oppressed us. But now it's a pity because our black government is making us suffer.
Sometimes she goes for days, at times a full week, without electricity. And there is no end in sight. Eskom, the government-owned monopoly, has admitted it has failed for more than a decade to invest, maintain, and deliver new power plants on time. It says load shedding will continue until 2017 to prevent the entire energy grid from collapsing. Those who can afford it resort to using generators, gas cookers, and even solar power during blackouts. But for the millions like Twala, there is no choice. The constant power cuts have rendered her electric stove useless. Her refrigerator has become a food spoiler, and her washing machine sits idly. She now has to use a smelly and unsafe paraffin stove for cooking. When she has no money for paraffin, Twala picks firewood in the bush to cook, but says that is last resort.
This is extreme torture. The smoke fills my eyes. The fire is too hot, but I still must cook. I cannot even express the suffering that we go through in winter.
The load shedding has also impacted students living in poor households. 20-year-old Phineas Ngomane also lives in Soweto. He says constant blackouts have forced him and fellow students to resort to candle light to study. This, he says, affects their efforts badly.
It's not safe, and sometimes, you know, the work doesn't become neat. You know, our marks become subtracted for neatness. So it becomes very difficult, and even the liquid that comes out of an kazel spilled into our books.
Like Twala, Phineas is also pleading with Eskom to switch the lights on and keep them on. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Bill. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Newly crowned Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's Sekafa Kagame Club Champions Azam of Tanzania Mainland received $30,000 cash bonus for their victory, Sekafa General Secretary Nicholas Musonye revealed in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania on Monday. According to Musonye, the bonus prize money comes from the tournament patron, who is Rwanda's President Paul Kagame. Musonye says tournament runners-up Gor Mahia of Kenya get $20,000 and third-placed Ugandan's Kampala City Council authorities return home $10,000 richer. Staying in Dar es Salaam, Zanzibar is bidding to stage the 2016 Sekafa Kagame Club Championship, Sekafa General Secretary Nicholas Musonye revealed on Monday. Musonye says they'll visit Zanzibar next month to assess their bid. Zanzibar last staged the regional event in 2002. Turning to basketball, Egypt outplayed Equatorial Guinea 145-48 at the Africa Boys Under-16 Basketball Championships in Bamako, Mali on Sunday. Earlier on, Angola beat Morocco 81-53. Mali outplayed Nigeria 88-54. Tunisia dismissed Ethiopia 81-53. Rwanda beat Equatorial Guinea 83-52. And Egypt outclassed Algeria 100-56. Finally, in motorsports, Kenyan Jaspreet Singh Chate won the Rwanda Mount Gorilla Motor Rally, which ended in Gahengeri, Rwanda, on Saturday evening. Zambia's Jassy Singh was runner-up ahead of Burundi's Valerie Bukera. This was the fifth leg in the Africa Rally Championship Series. Chate remains at the top of the series standings with 75 points. The sixth leg of the series is the Pearl of Africa Rally in Uganda at the end of this month. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, Bill.